Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always, episode 197, Kevin. That rhymed. That was clever. What's going on, man? How are you?
Hanging in there. Just keeping busy. We're recording on a day that's different than our normal day. So that we were actually at the farmer's market all morning today, and now we're not. it was just another one of those days, you know, just getting up at the, like, before the sun and getting out and selling food to people. So that was a good time.
That's great, man. Has your wife started to develop random food cravings that you have to satisfy with late night grocery runs?
That happened a long time ago. She was doing pickles for a long time, which is kind of like, you know, kind of the cliche. Right. And then it's kind of switched, and then it went to like chocolate, and then it went to pizza. Pizza, which is good, you know. So, and so she's been going to it, but then she's had to get some teeth extracted.
Oh boy!
So that's a good time. So she's getting she's got a bunch of dental work to get done. Has to get it done now, because like if you get a little infection or something, like having, you know, infection, gum infection, abscess or something, that can affect the baby. So they told her, get this stuff done. And they said, okay, we're going to pull those teeth out. And then she's like, okay, do I get some painkillers? Like, oh, of course not. You're pregnant. You can't have that.
Oh boy.
So try putting this bag of ice on it. And so she's been a little bit miserable, but still such a trooper and pulling through it. So, good times.
Yeah, dude, the fairer sex, their pain tolerance and their willingness to go the extra mile for their children. It's remarkable. It really is. If you're not familiar with that experience, everybody out there, I think, yeah, it's crazy. That's all I can say. Yeah, man, it's admirable. All right. We're going to talk about some stories now. Enough about our personal lives and wives and all that. So first up, he's more than just his DNA. Cloning a beloved pet costs up to $500,000, but there's no guarantees when it comes to personality. Next up, drought-tolerant crops. Here's one biotech innovation that only anti-GMO groups can demonize. And finally, we haven't approved a new antibiotic in nearly four decades. Bacteria are taking advantage of this blind spot. News at 11. Okay, Kevin, so I think this is a story about perpetual pets. I think these people are ripping you off pretty shamelessly.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, it's just funny that you mentioned that. I couldn't remember if we had talked about this before, but that was the idea right away when they cloned Dolly, was I bet there's a lot of people who would pay to get their pet back, you know, or at least clone their pet, or you could at least bank their pet's cells until they were ready to get it in the future. And this is an article by Craig Miller on MarketWatch. And it really does talk about this concept that since you can save an animal's cells or be able to clone that animal, then cloning animals is kind of reasonably simple now. People do this, you know, I shouldn't say it reasonably simple. It's being done since Dolly the sheep in 96 or whenever that was done, that you can do this with just about any domestic animal. So that's pretty cool. We do it with cows all the time. You know, there's other livestock that are cloned pretty readily. So dogs, I guess you can do this with about 20% success, and it costs about $50,000. And it's actually kind of funny. There's a couple of stories that are out there. I think it was this one that talks about the folks who cloned their beloved pet that they had done in South Korea. And that was about, there was something like $125,000 to do this. The next dog that they had that was cloned from the original one, which was a great name for the dog, was Encore. Yeah. And I know of a few other stories in this thing. There was another one of a woman who had a really important bull that she loved. And the bull's name was Chance. And this bull was fantastic, whatever it did, bull things it did, that when it died, they tried to clone it. And then they had another one, and its name, what was its name? Second Chance, right? And the neat part was is that these were cool experiments because the new animal wasn't exactly like the old one. And that was really the beauty of this whole story is that, you know, just because you can put the DNA, you can take the DNA out of a cell and ablate the nucleus of a fertilized egg and drop in that nucleus from the original animal and then somehow bring that back, you know, get it to start dividing and then make a whole new animal. You can make an animal that is indeed a clone, an identical twin, but there are differences. You don't get the same thing out. And what it suggests is a couple of things. It's not just a question of nature versus nurture, egg versus, you know, experiences, but probably a lot to do with the epigenetic phenomena that are present. So what's happening in terms of genes that may have been permanently silenced, genes that may have been turned on. Second Chance was not as pleasant as Chance and had some behavioral issues but some things were spot on, like the way it would stick its head in a feed bucket and then pull its head out. She says very characteristic of Chance, and Second Chance would do the same thing. So a lot of really interesting aspects there, because even though they're identical, that they still are not really identical. And a lot that we can learn from that in terms of biology, you know, just because you have exactly the same DNA, does it mean that you are exactly the same organism?
There's a lot of, maybe troubling isn't the right word, but like curious ethical edges to this issue that I hadn't considered before, mostly because we were making jokes about your biotech startup called Perpetual Pets. But I do think it's interesting because we're going to talk about our lack of antibiotic development later, but you can really tell where our priorities are when we talk about stories like this, because we have an abundance of boner pills and toenail fungus medicine and acids and antidepressants. And now we're trying to clone our dogs. And that's one question that I think we should explore. I'd really like your insight on that as a working scientist. But then there's the more important ethical issue of you have to go and find donor mommy dogs to gestate these puppies, yeah. You know? So there's that. And then one point that they mentioned in the story is that you have dogs in shelters. There's just dogs everywhere all over the world. They're unwanted, you know, and they don't have homes. And instead of trying to figure out a way to get those dogs rehomed, we're like, no, I want Second Chance. I want my Chancy back, even if it costs me the price of a Ferrari when I have this dog, even if he's kind of funky and he's not quite what I expected. So take either of those. What are your thoughts?
No, those are really important points. At first I never thought about that idea that you need to find a female dog to impregnate with fertilized embryos and give her hormones. You have to have a surrogate dog to do this. And I didn't ever consider that part of this equation before. So that is true. You now have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort to do this for a pet. And it kind of shows where our priorities are and that people are willing to plunk down this kind of bread for cloning another pet, you know, a pet, another animal that you could go to a shelter and get another one. I was like the comedian who said he had a cat that he got for free and he took it to the vet. And the vet says, well, we'll have to fix it or spay it and neuter it and do this other stuff and do some. And then it turns out that it's got something wrong. He can get some surgery. It's going to cost $1,214. And he said, I'll be right back. I left my checkbook in the car. I could get another free one, you know? So it really does show where our priorities are. So a cool story. Really, it's just an offshoot of what we can do with livestock, which is really important in the livestock industry because a good bull is hard to find. And certain bulls have sired millions of great-great-great-great-grandchildren, if you look back in their lineages, that they all come from common stock. So pretty interesting stuff there.
Maybe the upswing is what you mentioned, is this seems to be illuminating our understanding of epigenetics. So talk about why that's significant, because in the nature versus nurture debate, whatever the specific issue is that you're talking about, it tends to be like you have certain people on one side, they're like, everything's genetics, I'm a genetic determinist, stop denying the science. And on the other side, you have the people who are like, no, man, it's life and it's experience, bro. And like, so it sounds to me like, again, as is often the case, there's sort of a golden mean. There's a region on the spectrum right in the middle somewhere where you get a balanced view of everything. And that's where the truth seems to lie. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. But that's what's so fun about these experiments, is that the people who had their dog Encore cloned, you know, they were the same people who they were 10 years before when the first dog was a puppy. And Chance and Second Chance came from the same woman. And they were both probably treated similarly and in similar places with similar inputs, yet were still remarkably different. And what that shows us is it illuminates the power of epigenetics. The fact that there are genes that are changed in that egg, or in that cell that was the donor of the nucleus, which went into the egg. There were changes there that were present that were not present in the original fertilization event. So even though you have exactly the same genetic complement, it's not the same just to have the same genes. You have to have the same genes accessible to the mechanisms that express those genes. It's, not to go down another rabbit hole, but it's the argument when people say, well, this transgender stuff, well, I got XY and that means male. Not if the genes on the Y chromosome aren't expressed. And so it's not just enough to have the blueprint. You have to be able to act on the blueprint. And so that's where this is a really cool set of experiments to be able to show where those edges are. So cool stuff.
Okay, no doubt we'll return to perpetual pets at some point in the future. But let's talk about drought-tolerant crops, Kevin. And this is a story that I wrote a little while back for the American Council on Science and Health. And this is a well-worn topic. We've gone to this many, many times, so we don't have to belabor it too much. But I sometimes, just to keep my my blood boiling and my skills sharp, I go read the blogs of Non-GMO Project and Organic Consumers Association, all these goofy groups, you know, because I think one of the, and again, I think you'll agree with this too, is that one of the best ways you can interrupt this flow of nonsense that they have, you know, they put this content out, then they retweet it, then their friends retweet it. And you know what I mean? It's just this big cottage industry that they have going. One of the best ways you can do is you just go into the kitchen and you just, you know, throw some salt in the eggs, right? You just go in and shake things up. You go, no, that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong. And it just sort of screws up their plans. So I really, just personally, I get a little bit of joy out of doing this, but I do think it is very important. You go to their content, and they say things like one of the things they started with in this article was GMOs don't feed the world, and they're never going to feed the world. And you can start right there and go, okay, I've been writing about this for the better part of a decade now. I know dozens of people that do this for a living, and nobody says this. I don't know where you guys got this feed the world talking point from, but no one in industry says this. No one at any university that's reputable says this. It's like this thing that just you guys say, right? The more proper way to put it would be, we have a variety of breeding tools that we have access to. They have different strengths and different weaknesses. And we use the right one for the right job. And that's how we get the best chance of getting the result that we want. So we can talk about more, but let's start there, Kevin, because that's a really important point. They launch with this, you know, you can't feed the world with GMOs. And it's like, no one's saying that, guys. So what do you think?
No, I've said the same thing. I've told people for years, please avoid the feed the world thing. It comes off as really trite and patronizing and condescending. That it's not about feeding the world, it's about changing a world, if that world is your world. So in other words, if you're a a subsistence farmer in Bangladesh and you're pounding your eggplants with pesticides to keep them alive, having the BT brinjal, you know, the eggplant with the BT gene, having that available and not having to apply pesticides or as much, you know, being able to scout for different pests rather than fruit and shoot borer that, you know, that decimate these farms, these small subsistence farms, having that tool changes your world. And so it's not maybe feeding everybody, but for that family, it makes a huge difference. And so that's the way we need to communicate this. It's about, like, as you said, it's using a different set of tools to solve a problem for somebody or someplace, for people in the planet. How are we able to do that? By adjusting using this technology. And your focus on drought tolerance is a really important one. It's really good.
It reminds me, you wrote a paper just a couple months ago, I think, where you were talking about the history and the efficacy of grafting when you're trying to perpetuate fruit trees. And I forget the specifics, but I think the gist of your argument was, you know, we've been doing this for thousands of years. We still do it because it's incredibly effective for the goal we're trying to achieve. And I actually think I cited that paper here. I don't remember or not, but that's an interesting point. It's like, look, it's not about new or old. It's not about GMO versus non-GMO and all these other silly distinctions. It's just, you know, if you need to drill something, you use a drill. And it's as simple as that. It's just not that complicated. I don't know why these people are so hung up on this. The other really frustrating point is they start to drill in on how these drought tolerant research projects haven't yielded any results. And so there's two things to say here. The first is that that's just simply false. And all I did is I went and looked at the literature on this. There's lots of great organizations that monitor the kind of biotech research that's going on around the world. And they say, okay, here's this project. Here's when it started. Here's the results. And then you just look at those and you go, okay, you guys are wrong. I mean, there's like drought tolerant maize, for example. There's lots of varieties of that have already been commercialized and they're in use. And the farmers that grow them, according to this study that I cited, I believe this was in Ethiopia, I want to say, but the farmers who grow these varieties of corn, they earn an extra $240 per hectare of land that they use to grow this crop. That's a significant improvement for anybody. So the problem is that you need to get the distribution on a wider scale. You need more people to get access to it. And that's when you really start to see the significant results. And on that point, it's interesting, and I didn't really go into this in the story too much, is that the activist groups actively fight any sort of approval, you know? So it's like you create the problem and you go, well, look at this problem. You guys aren't doing anything. It's like, well, then get out of the way, please, and let us do our jobs. Go. What do you think? I mean, I know affected your work in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the old story that some of our journalistic friends do is, you know, they leave the banana peel at the top of the stairs. And then when someone slips and falls down the stairs, they say, look how dangerous the stairs are, you know, and they create the problem they report on. And so these groups that have fought, who go into these countries, whether it's Greenpeace or other organizations, go into developing world countries and say, this causes cancer. It's going to kill your children. It's going to cause this problem and this problem. And there were commercials that were in the movie Food Evolution that show this, that they're listening to commercials saying this will cause cancer, you know, and you, it kind of sounded like the guy who used to be on the 7-Up commercial.
That sounded like Vandana Shiva, Monsanto.
It is Monsanto. Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. No, they go into these countries and poison the well. And say that this can't work. It's going to be dangerous. It's going to be a problem. You're going to be beholden to the imperialist forces of the industrialized world. And they say all this stuff, and then they can't figure out why they stop the adoption. Like right now, they're fighting a tooth and nail in Kenya, and Kenya only quit the approvals back in 2012 because of the Seralini paper. Mm-hmm. So a paper that showed the three Lumby rats scared the hell out of the government. They shut down approvals, and now 10 years later, they still are. They're starting to crack that door open, and there's people fighting it. And wow, that's a great thread on Twitter, by the way. If you read hashtag GMO, I would say 30% to 50% of the back and forth is about Kenya. So yes, they have effectively shut it down by lying about it and then report, well, look, it hasn't done anything. It's a pretty, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that they create.
Here's another thing. This is a direct quote from the Non-GMO Project. They say that adaptations to stressors such as drought are generally complex traits. Genetic moderation operates at the level of a single gene or possibly a few genes, making it a poor tool for this particular job. I just find that argument hilarious because theoretically it's an interesting argument, and in some cases it is valid. There are instances, like with CRISPR, for example, it's not the right tool to achieve particular traits because you're making very discrete edits to specific pieces of DNA, and you can't get the result that you want. And so you have to use a different tool like transgenesis, for example. But in any case, it's funny here that they would make that argument because we have dozens upon dozens of examples of drought tolerance being developed. And even after this post was published, you had drought tolerant, or at least, you know, it could grow with less water, even if you don't want to technically call it drought tolerant. But you had soy, wheat, and corn that were approved very, very recently. I think Argentina very recently approved the wheat and the soy, and Brazil as well. So these are transgenic crops, and they're very directly debunking what Non-GMO Project is saying here. I find that utterly hilarious. They must know about this, and they just refuse to believe it, or they're just trying to ignore it. In any case, they're just dead wrong.
Yeah, well, it is a very dangerous thing to argue against, because drought tolerance isn't like insect tolerance, where you can feign the presence of an insecticidal molecule, or Roundup resistance, or, you know, herbicide resistance, where you can say, you have to douse it in glyphosate. This is something where you truly are doing something that's important, that aids in a farmer's ability to just make a living and fight back against climate change. And in the case of drought resistance, it doesn't. So here's the funny nuance of this, is that it doesn't always work. Okay, so you can't go into a situation where there's absolutely zero water and no rain coming at all and then expect the plant to live. And so people will say, look how it fails. You have to look in those cases where it's marginal, where you have a few days without some water, or some, you know, some passing drought. It won't go through a major drought where water never shows up. Plants need water. But in those times when there is a deficiency, you won't have the plants just die. And that's where this thing shines. It's in that funny little margin where plants would normally die but can survive a few extra days without water. And so it's easy to point to this stuff and say, look how it failed, because it's situations where the water just wasn't there at all.
It's a very good point. Very good point. One other thing I want to add before we move on to our last story, and this is another quote from Non-GMO Project. So I ask in the article, I say, okay, well, if you're going to reject all these viable solutions, what's your solution? And they address this in the story. They say, we believe the best solutions are based on local and indigenous knowledge, evolving with the participation of small farmers. These solutions emerge with the deepest respect for social and economic impacts, blah, 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 blah. Diversity is our strength. Equity is our goal. It's the same social justice gobbledygook. And it's like what I said. It's the analogy I used a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this, when you ask one of these groups, like, okay, how do you build a bridge? Well, see, we want a bridge that promotes equity that everyone can drive over. And it's like, yeah, but that's not what I'm asking you. Like, we all agree on that. Like, equality, it's an excellent principle. We all live by it, or at least we all should live by it. I need to know how you're going to build the bridge. Like, what kind of material are you going to use? Exactly how are you going to design it? How much weight is it going to hold? These are the kind of questions you need to address. And it's funny, if you talk to the people in these countries who are being denied access to this technology, they see access to technology as part of their indigenous knowledge, if you want to use this phrase. And I'm going to point you to an article that my colleague, Dr. Chuck Dinnerstein at ACSH wrote 2 months ago. It's called Religiosity and Risky Choices. And it's a study of how people in these developing societies, particularly in Africa, how they view risk and why they think it's appropriate to take one risk and to avoid another. And what they found in this study is that a lot of these countries, they see betting on new technology as as God's way of communicating to them, this is the tool I'm giving you to solve this problem, right? So this is, if you want to talk about indigenous knowledge and respect for their culture, allowing them access to these tools is highly respectful. And if you go to them and you say, look, we understand that this is your perspective, let us be a part of the solution with you, that's great. You're respecting their values, you're respecting their beliefs, and you're giving them the tools that they've already told you that they want access to. But it's funny, all of the wealthy white liberals that want that run these anti-GMO groups, they don't want any part of this indigenous knowledge. I just find that highly amusing. So I would encourage you, read Chuck's article and read the paper that he's talking about, because it just explodes this whole myth that these groups are perpetuating. Okay, Kevin, I'll take a breath.
Well, and you're exactly right. And the thing is that we talk about this idea of respecting indigenous knowledge. Okay, that's cool. They already have indigenous knowledge. And part of indigenous knowledge might be knowing where to turn to when others present some knowledge and some opportunities. So I agree. There's it's not disrespecting indigenous knowledge. It is respecting access to technology for people who want it. And that's what it's all about. And that's the easiest way to communicate this for those of you who engage is just let farmers make the choice. And if it's safe and it's been approved and it's something that can be helpful, let farmers have the choice. That's all we're asking.
Absolutely. Well-worn point. I just can't help but make it in passing. Is there anything more colonialist than stepping into the breach and saying, I'm going to protect your indigenous knowledge for you because like you don't really understand what this technology is. And so from my headquarters in New York, where I have bountiful food and air conditioning, I'm going to tell you how to farm. It's like, you guys are out of your minds. How dare you? Man, the ball's on these people, Kevin. It's just so preposterous. Okay. Sorry, everyone. Well,
I liked how you said that. I thought you were going to say from my headquarters in the valley. like I'm sure your indigenous knowledge. Me with a spoon. Yeah.
Everybody I hate has an uptalk like that. So basically, what I'm saying is I'm smarter than you. It's like it's just so I don't know. They're just so oblivious to how. I don't know. Okay. I'm getting older, so I'm starting to get that like middle age. I don't care what you think, and it does. Okay, it's beautiful. Okay, Kevin, antibiotics. Tell us about this.
All right. Actually, this is a really important story. So the fact that we haven't approved an antibiotic in four decades, this is by Mara McKenna at Wired, and this really illuminates something that I got to talk about this week. I was at a really interesting meeting. I think I can talk about this in Washington, D.C. about biosecurity and genetic engineering and all this good stuff. And it was a rather high-level thing. It was State Department and FBI and a bunch of other folks. It was really interesting. Nothing classified. Anything that I have that's classified, you can find here at Falta Lago. anyway.
Donald Trump joke.
Well, I did think to finally call my house Falta Lago. Falta Lago. I got to put that on the fence. Anyway, but one of the take-home messages is that we have shortages right now in antibiotics. And amoxicillin, which is being used for so many different applications, especially in things like childhood ear infections and stuff, it's just not available. It's very difficult to find. Huge shortages. And it's something that's been used it's used in many applications. Right now it's all being used for these upper respiratory infections that are just plaguing everybody, whether it's been a flu, whether it's COVID, whether it's RSV, amoxicillin is part of the equation. And right now it's back ordered through January, February, and most cases. And that there's something like 260 different drugs, like go-to drugs that are in either short supply or not available at all because mostly of quality control issues. And this is part of the modern day drug pipeline. And a lot of what I'm telling you isn't from necessarily this article, but also from this meeting, is that 90% of our drugs, 90% of the top 200 most important drugs come from India or China. Now think about that for a minute. The stuff that we use the most is not produced here. and the stuff we depend on is not produced here. So when you have supply chain changes or anything, that becomes threatened. And there's been a big push for more money to be invested here. I know that this article talks about the Pasteur Act. There's also been like the CHIPS and CHIPS and Science Act that was recently approved as an executive order, I believe, where this invests a huge amount to have chips that are used in electronics developed here in the United States, rather than relying on other countries to do it, because they're building all of our modern military stuff with chips coming from other countries that may have hostile intent towards the United States ultimately. And same with drugs. And so this idea of revamping our capacity to manufacture drugs is really important. Antibiotics are at the center of this, because antibiotic resistance is becoming an increasing problem. And every year it's like 50 million people in America die, millions who get ill from this, and that globally this is over a million people that become sick or die from antibiotic resistant bacteria. And this is really a problem with healthcare workers. People who go to hospitals now have to deal with this. My father, when he was in the hospital a lot, was getting MRSA infections that were antibiotic resistant, where they would say, you know, we got one drug that we can use here and $10,000 a dose. You know, so, you know, so you know, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, what are you going to do? So the very, very expensive alternatives, because that's all you got left. It's the last arrow in your quiver. And so now the question is, where do we go from here? And how do we come up with new mechanisms of action to develop the next generation of antibiotics? And how do we get that done? And that's really the gist of this entire article.
This is another example where you can see how skewed our priorities are. And right now I'm looking at a story, and anyone can look this up. It's been in the news lately, but the House of Representatives just passed, it's called the National Defense Authorization Act. It's passed every year. It's basically the military budget for the year. It's a record $858 billion just for a year that we're spending on defense for the United States. So I'm no expert on any of these topics, but just a thought, maybe we could take, I don't know, a percentage of that almost $1 trillion we're going to spend on bombs and tanks and, you know, weapon systems. Let's put a little bit of that towards the antibiotic development. Because if this is such a crisis, as everyone says it is, it sounds like we have money for, you know, all kinds of stuff. Like we build these really expensive machines and then you blow them up once and then that's all, they're not good for anything after that, you know? So I don't know, like reallocate some of that money. It seems like we have money to spend on stuff that we need. So let's do that. That's one thought. I don't know if you have any insight on that, Kevin, but in this Wired story, there's a point that it costs roughly $1.4 billion to get a new drug to the market, to do all the development, the R&D, get it through FDA approval. And this is one of the problems, right, is that you can't attract capital into antibiotic research and development because the people with the money are going, you know, I mean, this is an enormous amount of money. And then once these drugs are approved, they sell consistently, but slowly. And so it's hard to recoup your investment. So coming out of the pandemic, hopefully as we are, with these, you know, these state-of-the-art vaccines that were developed very rapidly, you know, so you did the research and the development alongside the clinical trials. That's what that emergency authorization allowed. Why can't we do something similar with antibiotics? And why can't we retool the FDA approval process? And just like we've talked about with Dr. Henry Miller's work, when he was at the FDA and they were reviewing the application for the first genetically engineered insulin product, Humulin, I believe is what it was called. They got it done in 5 months instead of 32 months or whatever the average was. So it seems to me, yes, like, you know, it wouldn't be a terrible idea. I mean, maybe we could argue about this, but it wouldn't be terrible to spend more money on drug development as a matter of, you know, federal policy. But maybe we could just make it easier to get these drugs developed and approved, and then you could attract the money you need from the private sector. I don't see why we can't at least try that. What are your thoughts, Kevin?
Well, why not public sector that thing? You know, you've got universities everywhere with lots of eggheads and labs and ideas who could develop new antibiotics. I know one big focus in my laboratory was to develop new antibiotics from random information, and it works. And yet I've written proposals for this and I'd get back. Yeah, sure. You know, so and it's just because there's not a lot of, there's not enough money to go around to do that kind of work in the public sector. But you're talking about $800 billion for defense for a year. The NSF budget, you know, our nation's major scientific driving engine, is about $8 billion. So it's 1% of the defense budget. And one might argue that the best defense is a good offense. That what, you know, what good is it that you have tanks and bombs when you've got antibiotic resistant bacteria that can kill the population or can really infect the population and cause tremendous healthcare costs. So I'm of course, a public sector professor, even though some will argue I'm not. that I really think that scientific enterprise is an important asset of our nation, and that this is an opportunity to invest in that and create public products that can move through these processes and be made licensable by all these companies that might want to manufacture or sell them and come across with something that's cheaper or something that's affordable that can work. And I love the idea of the fast track. I wouldn't call it warp speed again, because that was kind of a bummer because it gave the impression that this was a sloppy process, but maybe call it careful and very cautious.
Operation very quickly.
Operation safe and careful.
Rapid, safe and careful.
Yeah, that doesn't carry the same punch. But the big issue is, again, back to the money. It costs a fortune for these companies to create these products, as you mentioned. Something like 3% of what is devised through R&D ever makes it to the drugstore shelf. And so you got to pay for all the research and the 97% of failures. And some of those proceed into clinical trials and animal trials that are so expensive. So the new blockbuster drug has to be able to pay for all the stuff that failed. And so you got to make big bucks on it in order to break even. So it's such a snake eating its own tail kind of problem. What we really need is to break that model and come up with ways to be able to create new drugs that's faster and more agile, much like you said, like the vaccine. So the big deal now is the Pasteur Act, which seems like the act du jour, and I'm not sure if this has actually been voted on or not. These things get authorization. Let me get this right. They get approval, but not, they get authorization, but not budgetary approval. So in other words, you can get an executive order that'll sign off on it. You can get Congress to float it, but until the money is appropriated, you don't have an act. You don't have a formal act. And the last big example here, this Pasteur Act, this thing was loaded with, it was something like $11 billion, which seems okay. That's a good chunk of dollars. But it still isn't very much. And it was $11 billion that was earmarked to, well, we're going to get panels of experts and we're going to look at current needs and social value and equity of how this would be accessed. You know, the stuff that we talked about, you know, in the beginning about genetic engineering. But what they need is fundamental research on finding the new mechanisms of action that can be targeted with antibiotics. They need the more fundamental research to develop the plan before we start worrying about equity and access. Maybe if some would argue with that. But I think we need equity and access. Best way to do that would be private sectorize this thing. But anyway, bottom line is we need more dollars going that way. And right now, as it stands, Pasteur Act, I think, is at $6 billion, which if it's approved. And really, that's how much it costs every year, about somewhere in that neighborhood, for the CDC to deal with antibiotic-resistant infections. So it would be a wash if we could come up with new drugs for $6 billion, at least get the ball, you know, kick the snowball down the hill and let's see what happens. That would be a really big step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you just made about how the legislation authorizes this new commission and they're going to say, well, you know, the drug costs this much, so it should provide this much value, and then we're going to disperse payments and, you know, periodic payouts, blah, 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 blah. that's a really interesting point. I'm looking at a paper right now. It was authored by a biochemist named Terence Keeley. And he's with the Cato Institute now, but he wrote a book back in the day called The Economic Laws of Scientific Research. And he makes the case that you need less federal involvement in basic scientific research. And this is one of the reasons is because, and the paper, the argument they make is that the more money the government siphons out of the private sector into these different research projects, it attracts the talent, if you will, into the federal bureaucracy. So instead of people going to universities like where Kevin is at the University of Florida, or going to a biotech company or starting their own biotech startup where they can do this research, they go into federal research and these kind of things where there's a certain amount of it that's necessary. You need regulators and you need researchers on the federal payroll, but you have fewer people actually doing the work that's going to get the drugs to market. So they call it, it's a crowding out effect in economic lingo is what they talk about in this paper. But it's really interesting. I would encourage everybody to read it because the point they're making is you need to stop sucking money out of the private sector and allow it to work. You know, so if the FDA would come out and say, we are prioritizing the approval process for new antibiotics and we're going to do it safely, just like we did with the COVID vaccine development, but we're going to streamline the process and we want this to go fast. And we want to ensure safety and efficacy, but let's get on this. If you could get a campaign like that going, you would get the investment into this project. But it just seems, for whatever reason, very few people want to talk about this issue that way, and I find that a bit bothersome. Anyways, yeah, go.
But it can be done. I mean, when you look at the great example of this is how the United States government bankrolled the vaccines. You get a lot of private sector work that really blew up the vaccine and really got it going. It was a huge step forward. At the same time, churning away in the background, Peter Hotez and his group, they were coming up with a public sector solution. And they came up with a vaccine that's been approved and is stable and it's produced for the developing world. And huge amounts of this thing are being administered in India. So here's an example where now using a public sector solution to solve the problem and it works. So, and he's not getting paid a penny for it, you know, so it wasn't done in an entrepreneurial spirit. It was done to solve a problem. And I think we need a little more of that.
Absolutely. And one thing that's interesting is that you have a lot of these like bored billionaires with all this money that they don't know what to spend on. And so they start philanthropies and they go look for viable projects to invest in. So again, if you had the federal government come out and say, we're prioritizing this, you could, a lot of rich bored billionaires would be like, okay, I'm going to go find Peter Hotez, or I'm going to go find Paul Offit, or I'm going to go find a vaccine research group somewhere and I'm going to dump money on them and fund their work. That would be great. You know, wherever it comes from is fine. I'm just saying you could remove some of the restraints. And this would be great. But by the way, I could be mistaken, Kevin, but was Pfizer's vaccine part of Operation Warp Speed? I want to say it wasn't. I want to say that they just developed it without federal funding, or maybe it was one of the others.
No, it was enabled, but with federal funding. It was Pfizer and Moderna did receive money towards development of the vaccines. It was done by BioNTech, Pfizer combination, because these other companies had been working on mRNA technology for a long time. And despite what people thinking this being the newest, best, and greatest, it's been in the works for a while. Really, the concept since the 1980s, very conceptually, in reality, since probably 2005, where the big breakthrough with Carrico and Weizmann's recoding of mRNA, and then really development starting in the 2010s, you know, like probably 2013, these things started going into clinical trials, I think. So it was all, but the big push for the COVID version was something that happened in 2020, and that was government enabled.
Interesting. I could be wrong. I'm trying to look up Warp Speed right now. I want to say one of the companies didn't get very much, or they, I don't know.
But when you talk, because we talked about, there's 100-something companies that were trying to do this back in the beginning when we were talking about this at the beginning of COVID. And if there are billionaires, you know, you talk about Hotez and Offit and all of the stars of vaccine development, you know, Folta is in there too. you know, my lab could use a little help. So
please, may I have some research funding? Yeah.
Well, and the big thing for us is that, you know, we've got a really cool system where we can design molecules that never, not design, we can produce molecules that never existed in the universe before and show that they interact with biology. And that we can break biology with plants. That's one of the things I talked about this week at this meeting in Washington. Whereas the modern synthetic biology mantra is to build it and to test it and then to learn from that and then rebuild it and retest. Mine, it isn't a build test model, a build test learn model. It's a make break model. And my model is how do we wreck biology? And I think that's why I got invited. We're able to break biology, and there's no reason we can't do it with bacteria. And we showed that we could. It's very difficult to find funding to do this kind of work, because one of the comments is, even if you find a new mechanism of action that breaks it and can be our new herbicide or new antibiotic, you're not going to be able to develop this. You know, it'll be 20 years before this gets anywhere. And that's a reason to not fund it. Yeah, so it's right. So that's really the disturbing reality. The panels that look at this say, since there's nowhere this can go, let's not throw money at it. And that's the reality.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we've got plenty of money to expose earthworms to glyphosate and then hit them with tasers. You know, it's just like the world's just such a screwy place, dude. It's so
sure.
You know, if I was a more cynical person, I'd be upset. But it's just funny. You know, it's absurd. I don't know what to tell everybody. But there you go. There's lots of solutions.
Oh, and you always have billions of dollars to build a new sports stadium.
Yeah, it goes on and on.
It's an old Jell-O Biafra thing. You know, we don't have money for healthcare, but we can always find money to build a new sports stadium. You know, he was always would bring that up, because it's funny that places like, you know, city of Chicago, where I used to live, they don't have chalk in the classrooms, where they still have chalkboards, because they don't have dry erase boards. You can always pull money out when it's something like sports related. You can find a few millions of dollars. And so just as our priorities, and that's the big theme of this entire episode today, is where really are our priorities? Are they in cloning pets or you know, it really is a thread that went through all of today's discussion.
Very good. All right. Who are you following on Twitter, Kev?
I don't know.
Let me go and you'll find somebody. No,
go ahead. You're up. Go ahead.
I'm gonna recommend you follow Dr. Chuck Dinnerstein. He's not very active on Twitter, but you can find his work at acsh.org. Chuck's a fascinating guy. He's a retired vascular surgeon, so he spent his whole career saving people's lives, which is cool. But he's an insightful writer, and he's not, unlike me, he's not trying to like make an argument and call people a spade, you call a spade a spade. Like, he's just more interested in analyzing things and bringing interesting research out. So he wrote an article just a couple days ago called WTF, The Health Benefits of Swearing. And there was some study done somewhere where they were documenting the physiological benefits that you get from swearing when you're angry. And the basic idea is, it's like you start to boil over, and then when you swear, it's like hitting the reset button or the eject button. And then you start to sort over and you go, okay, let me work on being more mindful. And then like you get to this, you know, you get to the edge again, and then you go, you know, so that's like, it lowers your blood pressure. It releases endorphins, all interesting stuff. But Chuck finds all these articles. He just keeps an eye on what's coming out in the peer reviewed literature, and he writes it up. So it's really interesting. I've learned a lot from reading his work, and I encourage everybody to. Okay. Do you have anybody?
Yeah, I do. And I'm going to think about that study, because the guy who I know, who he lived well into his 90s, he was an old boss of mine who could swear for about 45 seconds straight and not repeat the word. Now think about that. Just try it sometime. Just when you're home alone, just go in the bathroom and start screaming and swearing. And it's really hard to do for more than like 15 seconds. He could go almost a full minute and not repeat a word. It was amazing. He was one of the angriest people I ever met. It was pretty awesome. And he lived a long time. I think a person to follow is someone I've recommended before, is Melanie Teresa King at Thinking Powers. And the reason that I would recommend her, I had taught this class this year in logic and reason, especially as applied to medicine and biotechnology. And I'm getting back all the reviews. And people absolutely loved her visit virtually to the classroom, as well as at Natural Diaries, who's Britt Hermes. And the students of the class just really appreciated these two exceptional women scientists who have revised or created changes in either their philosophy towards science or the way they teach science to do it really well. And those are two accounts that I would be absolutely certain to follow. So that's it from my end. Thanks, Cameron.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure, Kevin. Episode 197 in the can, everybody. We'll be back next week for 198. Follow us as well at Kevin Folta on Twitter, at ACSH.org for my writing. And go to my website, CameronJEnglish.net. Everything I do is posted there. So thank you guys as always, and we will see you next time.